This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind a Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right! They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait! There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters is a special episode of the Really Awful Movies Podcast 71B, a chat about the creature features Squirm and Slither with Scott Drebbit from The Daily Dead.
So, it's our honor and pleasure to once again be talking with Scott Drebbit from Daily Dead and Deadly Magazine. Scott, how are you doing today?
I am doing great, gentlemen. Thank you for having me back on the Really Awful Movies Podcast. For all goodness and badness in cult, exploitation, horror, sci-fi, Lifetime, Cinemax, Showcase, Cinema, Slash, I'll just stop now. How's that?
That was an incredible promo, man.
That was a little long, but
No.
It's great to be back, guys, and I appreciate you having me back.
Yeah, your genial host will have to replace our tagline with that, if you don't mind.
It's all yours.
It's our new promo. So, as last time where we talked about Kingdom of the Spiders and Devil's Reign, we did a bit of a Shatner shitfest.
Oh, yes. Fabulous.
And we talked about two films with a connective thread, of course, that being, William Shatner. Whereas this time, we're going to talk about two films. Slither from 2006, directed by James Gunn, and Squirm from 1976, 20 years prior, directed by Jeff Lieberman, and the connective thread of these two is worms.
Yes, creepy crawlers definitely would be the connective tissue between the two, as well as both feature film directorial debuts for both.
Quite true, and they're both fucking awesome in their own ways, if you pardon my French.
Yes, they are. There are some differences, but I could not agree with you more. They both are both fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So we'll start off with Slither.
When you marry someone, you promise to love them forever.
Baby.
No matter how much. They might change.
Brian? Baby, what happened to your face?
It's just a bee sting.
From Universal Pictures.
Are you sick or something?
Comes a film so shocking.
We got a real problem here.
So disgusting.
Don't let him in your mouth!
It will change the face of horror.
Marriage is a sacred bond, for better or worse.
Much worse.
Chick is hardcore.
Go
with me.
Slither.
Now, this is a film that it's sort of out of the Driven era, obviously, but this is a wonderful throwback to some of those great creature features that we both love.
Oh, absolutely. I think it goes back as far to the 50s, certainly with the modern-day polish on it, but you could look at films like The Blob.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a touch of The Blob in there, and then, you know, going forward from The Blob, the 60s, 70s, you stop at the 80s, and Slither would make an amazing double bill with The Night of the Creeps.
As I was watching this film, and I'm always want to take down notes, I wrote down Night of the Creeps.
Well, there you go. Mediocre minds think alike.
Exactly. That's the thing about James Gunn. I mean, he loves his horror. He got his start at Troma. He wrote the incredible Romeo and Juliet. And then, of course, went on to direct movies such as Slither, Super, and of course, a little film, didn't do that well, Guardians of the Galaxy.
I was also going to say, really made his druthers as a writer with Troman. He also wrote Terror Firmer, which was another really good Troma film that's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then, he really popped on a lot of people's radar with the Dawn of the Dead, writing the Dawn of the Dead remake.
I forgot about that.
Because it was actually good. and he also wrote the two Scooby-Doo movies.
I was going to say, I forgot about Scooby-Doo.
Well, they're not very good, so
you can't get them. But with Slither, the guy pays homage to his Troma roots, because at one point a character is watching a television set, and there's a brief scene from The Toxic Avenger, which I completely appreciated. And there's...
Yes. I was just going to say, what is her... I forget what her character's name is, but she does play an important part in the movie, yes.
Mm-hmm. Brenda, I believe it was. And there's so many other little homages to amazing movies, like, for example, The Evil Dead. It starts off with a giant meteorite hitting the Earth.
Of course. As all good films do.
Exactly. And then, when that meteorite opens up, you know, that's when the creatures come out. But the camera movements that kind of lead into the forest to bring us to the meteor, that's pure Sam Raimi Evil Dead.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, of course, what's really great about Slither 2 is, it is purely a labor of love. Of a genre flick, but you can tell he's a great screenwriter because he really, in very short time, establishes who these characters are with really great, solid character development in a really short time. Like, it's great genre writing when you can do that. You know, all the greats have done that. You know, Carpenter, Raimi, comes to mind. The character, you're right in there, right from the start. As soon as he introduces these characters, they're not types, they're actual people, you know?
A little exaggerated for comedic effect. A good example would be the mayor.
But almost every mayor character is, in these type of films, because there always has to be the one person who doesn't believe what's going on in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a great character actor like Greg Henry, I would probably let him loose too.
And he's the incredible Mayor Jack, and his dialogue is unbelievable. Some of the lines he says are just, like,
that thing wants you to eat it?
Yeah. Or, this shit's about as far from God as shit can get. I don't want to turn to a fucking mollusk. I mean, all just pure foul mouth, cowardly, just, unbelievable. Another amazing character that, we need to talk about, because he sort of gets a whole ball rolling, if you will, is Grant, played by the always incredible Michael Rooker.
Oh, and I guess that's what I was, alluding to, saying, because the writing is so, when you have such strong writing, and Grant is such a unique character, and then you pair it with someone like Michael Rooker, who has such an imposing presence on screen, and then you have him playing not quite a Michael Rooker character. It's not his typical growly
mm-hmm.
bad guy role. He is a conduit for the villain, you might say, but he's a fascinating character.
He's sympathetic.
Yes, exactly. You do feel for him. He has some kind of disconnect in his life, and again, you know, this is, again, it goes right back to the fantastic writing, because right from those scenes with him and Brenda, or I should say previously the scenes with his wife, and then he ends up with Brenda, it really sets in motion his conflict. So you have this guy who's got his conflict, and in a typical movie like this, he wouldn't have any conflict at all.
He's this woman, Brenda, who's sort of like this woman he's kind of seeing on the side, a little reticent about it, because he does have a wife whom he loves, Starla, played by Elizabeth Banks.
Yeah.
And, but he gets infected. What does he get infected by? I guess you would call it a space worm.
Space worm, pine needle, large pine needle, whippoorwillow.
It's an incredible scene how basically it just goes into his mouth, and then you get this sort of like X-ray of his body, and you see how the worm worms its way, no pun intended, to his brain, and yeah, it turns him into a creature, sort of gradual at first, and eventually he becomes, wow, I don't even know what to describe him, except to say that he kind of reminded me of Dr. Pretorius from Beyond. But
oh yes, there you go, exactly, it's a whole lot of Pretorius. See, and there's, like you were saying, the whole movie is littered with horror references. And that's another, you know, connective tissue that it has with Night of the Creeps, because Night of the Creeps, again, because it was a love letter to the genre, you get the naming, everything is named after a famous horror person or horror director. Fred Decker did it in Night of the Creeps, and James Gunn did it here, and you always forgive it because it's their first movies, and it's like, you know what, go for it, guys.
Yeah, Hennenlauter's Bar, like, what a great place to drink at.
I would be there.
The Deer Cure at Hennenlauter's Saddle Lounge. Any bar named Hennenlauter's, I'm there any day of the week, man.
The Shit Kicker Saloon.
Even with the wonderful karaoke version of the Kraken Game.
I was going to say, this film has the best rendition of the Kraken Game I've ever heard in my life.
Awesome.
It's definitely the most moving. It brings you to tears.
It was so imbued with pathos because they didn't play it like a bunch of hicks sort of lambasting this poor outcast. They were very sympathetic to her in a way you wouldn't necessarily expect, especially when we see the welcome that was given to outsiders in the Squirm later.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys are from small towns, but I grew up in a small town, and well, that scene makes you cry, all right, because that is every small town bar in not only Canada, but I'm sure the world.
It brought me to tears. I mean, that rendition was unbelievable. We like karaoke. We've frequented enough karaoke bars in our time, and we've seen some good karaoke. We've seen some bad karaoke. Now, that would be considered bad karaoke, but in Hennenlauter's bar, this was good karaoke. You know?
It sure beats like a duo doing Islands in the Stream.
Yeah, this is probably a capacity night for Hennenlauter's karaoke.
And you got to forgive any movie that has Air Supply on the soundtrack as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Are you a fan of Castle? Of Castle, the TV show.
Oh, I thought you were talking about William Castle. Oh. I'm making reference to The Tingler.
You know what? I never saw Castle, but I think probably, and I never watched Firefly.
Nor have I.
Because it's weird,
This is probably my introduction to
Nathan Fillion.
Well, he's terrific. He's such an engaging, relaxing performer on screen. You know, he's kind of like the younger brother of Jason Bateman. He has that easygoing charm, not give a fuck kind of attitude to him that's really infectious on screen.
Mm-hmm. Although this is a bit of an aside, have you seen The Gift with Jason Bateman?
I haven't seen The Gift yet.
It's a decent flick. Jason Bateman playing a role that's completely against type. Without a doubt, he is the heavy in this movie, and it's well worth seeing. Just for seeing, you know, again, Jason. I mean, he plays a bully. Who would ever suspect Jason Bateman as a bully.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
But that's just an aside.
Alright, so do I still need to see it, or have you just given away the plot twist?
Well, I mean, you know, there's more to it than that. Don't get me wrong. It's not a perfect film, but I went into it with some extremely low expectations, and I was pleasantly surprised. It's a bit of a horror thriller. It's not really horror, it's more of just a bit of a psychological thriller, but it's worth seeing if you have absolutely nothing else you want to see. You know?
As soon as you said Jason Bateman against Tide, that there's really only one way to go with that. As he's always the good guy.
Yes. And in this one he plays a reprehensible piece of shit, and it's there's another actor in it, whose name escapes me at the moment. Joel Edgerton. He's a talented actor, and actually he wrote and directed it, and it's a pretty auspicious debut, I gotta say. It's worth seeing. It's good. Not great, but good.
All right.
Anyhow, getting back to Slither. So, what were we talking about before I derailed this conversation completely?
Well, I think I derailed the conversation with Nathan Fillion, who is starting to look like a castle, if you've ever seen the show. Like, he's about twice the size now. And the premise of that show that he's on is that he's a horror writer that solves crimes with police officers, because he's a mystery writer. And they have him as if, like, detectives don't know enough about solving murders that they need a fucking fiction writer to help them out. But anyway, that's an aside. But yeah, he's so effortlessly charming in this, and again, you know, half the size. And as is Elizabeth Banks, obviously from 40-Year-Old Virgin. I mean,
and many
she's
other
just
stuff.
So
but Hot American
sweet,
Summer, yep.
Like unbelievable. Like, it's such rich performances in this by everyone.
Well, it is, and you know, and again, like I was saying, it's all set up. Everything is set up for them to hit it out of the park, and they all completely do. Like, there isn't even Brenda, who would seem like a minor character in the film, gets some great dialogue later on when she gets, speaking of getting a little bit bigger.
Ah, yes, indeed.
A little bit bigger.
She becomes a giant flesh balloon with a face, but
everyone gets, there isn't a badly written part in the movie. You know, even Jenna Fisher gets off a couple lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Jenna Fisher?
Yeah, she was married to James Gunn at the time. Mm-hmm. Jenna Fisher from The Office. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was actually quite envious because I had a huge crush on Jenna Fisher back in the day. I even wrote her, this is really embarrassing, I wrote her a fan letter.
No, you didn't.
I did. I was on her MySpace page.
And now you have to stay 101 feet away from her?
No. She sent me back an 8x10 autographed, I gotta say. It was quite, you know.
Oh, boy.
So sweet.
It is sweet. It was MySpace, so we connected through MySpace.
Don't get defensive. It's all right. Did you shut down your MySpace account, or is it still open?
How many dead MySpace accounts are out there right now? Because I never did.
By the time I got around to finding out about MySpace, I think it was already, there were tumbleweeds rolling through.
Did you have a MySpace, Chris?
I did indeed. And it seemed like everyone accepted a friend request. No matter how low you were on the social media totem pole, that everyone has accepted.
And we all had the same friend, too. Tom.
Yeah, Tom, yeah.
Good old Tom from MySpace. I was like, holy shit, I got this friend. I don't know who he is. Then I realized he was this, like, bot friend that everybody had who created a MySpace page.
everyone needs a bot friend.
But anyway.
I can't say I missed the MySpace, but okay.
Well, hey, I mean, it procured me an 8x10 autographed photo of Jenna Fisher, who, as I said before, I had a huge crush on at the time. This was around the time of the first second season of The Office, and so for that I am forever grateful and in debt to MySpace.
I don't blame you. She's an attractive lady and a very funny, funny lady. Both her and Elizabeth Banks and Brenda just knock it out of the park. The humor is so... it's integrated so well in this movie. You know, it's in that rarefied air of your, you know, Shaun of the Deads, your Howlings, for some people, American Werewolf in London. Mm-hmm. You know, it's firmly entrenched in that category, especially when I rewatched it the other night. It's probably been a long time since I saw it. And man, it still plays as well as it did when it came out.
And you know what? The other thing, too, well, before I get into what I was about to say, I want to just go back to Brenda for a moment. And you talked about her, you know, who would, someone who would ostensibly be a minor character, and yet even she has a bit of pathos. When they discovered her in that barn, and she was that giant flesh balloon with a face, and she had the wonderful line, "Something's wrong with me. I don't want anyone to see me like this." And then, yeah, like, "Something's wrong with you? I think something's very wrong with you." And then, of course, she goes, "These fuckers are tearing me apart." And she just explodes into a million wonderful, slithery creatures.
After they all fat shame her. She needs bariatric surgery.
I think if she had used the gastric band, everything would have turned out okay for her.
And that's what I would name my backup band.
Use the gastric band.
Yeah, yeah.
So, the eyes of Barbara Steele... with the gastric band. That's the new band for the Really Awful Movies podcast. Yeah. Okay. And, yes, I think that, I mean, for a movie that came out in 2006, I think it's only gaining appreciation as the years go on. It's certainly become a cult classic.
It has, and, you know, another thing as well, of course, you know, Gunn coming from his trauma background where really, you know, CGI ain't nothing but three letters. His practical background, I think there's very, very little noticeable CGI anyway. There's tons of practical effects, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is the, you know, horror fans we shoot for, mm-hmm. And they're fantastic, and they still hold up, and what CGI I noticed is still actually, holds up, you know, pretty well. I have the Rock Scorpion King barometer, right? If it's anywhere better than the Rock as the Scorpion King at the end of Mummy Returns looks, then you're on the right track.
You know what is the most egregious CGI as far as I'm concerned? I guess this would be my barometer, was Van Helsing.
Steven Summers, that's a whole, yeah. Well, that's a whole podcast completely.
That's true, because those are both Steven Summers films, come to think of it.
I like, as a side note, what's the one? Deep Rising. I like Deep Rising. That's kind of a goofy, fun one. Mm-hmm. But after that, yikes. Not a fan.
Nor am I. Yeah, I mean, this movie's just goofy fun. Okay, as far as fun, you know, can be when you have, like, you know, proboscis? What is a plural of proboscis?
Proboscis? What is it?
You have proboscises, proboscising.
It sounds like a plant.
You
gotta water my proboscis.
You got people getting, sliced in half with their guts literally being spilled out. I mean, you know, you got people turning into gigantic squids. It's unbelievably wonderful carnage. But at the same time, the movie's got a heck of a lot of heart, and it's so bloody entertaining. It really is a love letter to the genre.
It is, and you know, and again, it really does come down to the writing, because the writing is so strong that even if it was filled with crappy CGI, which it isn't, but if it was, I wouldn't even care, because it's so well written, and it's such a love letter to, really, to drive-in films from the 50s to the 80s. Obviously, the stuff that, you know, that Gunn grew up with, and even if the acting was dicey, which again it isn't, mm-hmm. even if the directing was sloppy, which it's far from, it would still be entertaining because the writing is so good. But he hits it out of the park on all those fronts.
So true. And it's funny because, you know, with Guardians of the Galaxy, I remember, I mean, well, it wasn't that long ago. It was only about a year ago. My short-term memory is starting to really disappear with age. But leading up to that movie, can you relate, Scott?
Yo, totally.
What were we just talking
about? No, I was going to say.
I forget completely.
In Kingdom of the Spiders.
Yes, exactly. So William Shatner, no. But the thing with Guardians, I remember there was a bit of chatter on the internet saying, oh, this is going to be Marvel's first flop. I mean, these characters are B-list, C-list, D-list, and we have this unknown director at the helm. And the movie came out, and it was a massive success. It actually, I think, was a high-grossing film of last year. And a lot of people weren't familiar with Slither. And some of his other work thought that this James Gunn just sort of came out fully formed and made this tremendously entertaining blockbuster, but no, I mean, the guy paid his dues first in the Troma School, which say what you will about Troma, but it's one of the best incubators, I think, for filmmakers.
Lloyd Kaufman is like the Medici of like, you know, indie filmmaking.
Well, if you're going to work on a Troma production, you're going to learn your stuff. This boot camp, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, he basically, he did not come out fully formed. He was making a lot of good stuff beforehand. This arguably being the best pre-Guardians of the Galaxy James Gunn film. Post-Troma, pre-Guardians.
You know, he first came on, Gunn came on my radar with the Dawn of the Dead remake because, like myself and I'm sure a lot of other horror fans, you hear something like that is being remade and...
Oh my lord.
Oh, okay.
When I first heard that they were remaking that film, Scott, I don't know, man. I was ready. I think it was, you know, on the internet or something. I wanted to throw my computer monitor right through the window. There's certain things that we feel are untouchable. Well, a lot of these films have now been touched, i.e. The Thing, what have you, but...
And soon to be Martyrs and God knows what. Oh, jeez, yeah. But yeah, that thing gripped me from the first scene. I was just riveted. Easily in the top 10 best remakes of all time.
Oh, it's fantastic. It hits the ground running. And then you get the Johnny Crash credits, and then, you know, and away we go. And when it's done, it is absolutely one of the best horror remakes because, and this I think is what bodes well as a huge horror fan and a person of great respect, kept in all the great aspects of that movie and took it in its own direction slightly while still paying homage to the original. Mm-hmm. And that's really what, if it had been a beat-for-beat remake in the mall with that social commentary, it wouldn't have worked. But, you know, he says, okay, we get the social commentary, but, you know, this is 2004 or whatever it was, 2003, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a passé thing, so let's trim it, let's make it lean, let's just make a great, you know, monster movie, and man, it's fantastic. And after that I thought, okay, when I heard about Slither, I thought, oh, okay, this is the guy who wrote, now it wasn't the guy who worked for Troma or the guy who wrote Scooby-Doo, it's, oh, this is the guy who wrote Dawn of the Dead,
mm-hmm.
Giddy up, let's go.
Yep. And Dawn of the Dead, I mean, you know, that was filmed right in our backyard in a suburb of Toronto. Monroeville Mall was substituted by this mall called Thornhill Square, which pretty much was Monroeville Mall. I mean, it was just this completely desolate mall with, like, one anchor store and one restaurant in the food court.
And no bookstore, like, which is the hallmark of a great mall, obviously, you know?
And after they filmed that movie, they demolished the mall. It's no longer there. But, yeah, I mean, yeah. I remember, like, as I was saying before, I was livid when I heard they were remaking it, but when I sat down in the cinema to see it, I was pleasantly surprised. And at the end of the film, when the credits rolled, I was like, damn, that was actually a lot better than I expected. So, hey, you know, does it supplant the original? No.
I felt the same way about The Hills Have Eyes. It was just, you know, a really supercharged remake that it was true to the original, and, you know, again, one of the few that was just, you know, off the charts. Just go for the excitement, go for the gusto.
Yeah, well, you know, what's great, though, is you said, you know, did it supplant the original, but what's great about a great reboot is you don't, and a great original is, when the remake is great, you don't have to say, is it as good as the original? Does it supplant the original? It's its own being, and it gets thrown into that great remake category instead of just an inferior film, completely comparing it to the original and saying, this part isn't as good, this part isn't as good, this part isn't as good. But when it's so great, like Dawn of the Dead and Gunn's writing, you don't have to compare it because it's its own great... It takes on its own life away from the original, you know?
Yes, they coexist nicely. I mean, they're both, you know, they're both worthy of admiration. I mean, I'm thinking about The Fly, you know, Cronenberg's The Fly, one of the best horror remakes of all time. I love it, and I also love the original Vincent Price classic. Another one of the greatest horror remakes of all time, of course, is Carpenter's The Thing. Does it supplant the 50s creature feature? Absolutely not. That's great, too, you know? So, Yeah, I mean, that's what, even the Blob, the Blob, the 80s, I think it was 86?
88.
Yeah, does not supplant Steve McQueen's Blob, it coexists. These are some great horror remakes. Not every horror remake is, let's say, Carrie.
Oh.
That abomination with Chloe Grace Moretz, who's a pretty good actress, but I mean, what a terrible remake, reimagining, whatever you want to call it.
Updating. That movie wasn't her fault at all. She is a fine actress.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, that's one that tried to climb its way up to be on the same level as the original, but it doesn't. But it's interesting, you were talking about the comparisons between the originals and the remakes of those other films, The Fly, The Thing. For me, those remakes were taking material that not as sophisticated, and it's very much, they're very much of a time, and I'm not trying to, absolutely not trying to shit on those movies, but I think those remakes took simplified material and definitely fleshed them out more, and really, I thought, made them better, whereas I thought Gunn had a harder time of it and succeeded because he was dealing with something that was already canon in horror film. You know,
no doubt.
When someone said, you know, when Cronenberg was remaking The Fly, they thought, well, you know, that was a great drive-in flick from the 50s, but I don't think, you know, anyone was comparing it to, you know, Bride of Frankenstein or anything like that. But man, when, you know, I can just imagine when Gunn sat down to do a remake, to write a remake of Dawn of the Dead, his boots must have just been shaken.
Agreed. I mean, Dawn of the Dead is on the Mount Rushmore of horror.
Absolutely, and I guess what my long-winded point was, he had more of an obstacle to cover, and it's just a testament to how great of a writer he is that he was able to not only make something as good as the original, but stand apart from the original.
Mm-hmm. And now that Guardians of the Galaxy became the success that it has, I mean, he's Hollywood royalty, so it'll be interesting to see where his career goes from here.
Are you saying we can't get him on the podcast?
You know what? We just may be able to, because according to Lloyd, he's still a really decent down-to-earth guy.
Huh.
I was watching the special features on Slither the other night, and he seems like a fantastic guy, and the if you ever watch the behind-the-scenes stuff on Slither, it's absolutely hilarious. It looks like the most fun movie set ever.
I can imagine. I mean, you know, you have... I mean, first of all, I got Michael Rooker on set, and the guy is a character both on screen off. I met him, and he very nearly almost choked me to death in the process of taking a selfie with me, but it was an affectionate choke. he's a bit of a nutter, you know what I mean? But a good nutter. I really like Michael Rooker. And yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Banks is such a talent, and Nathan Fillion, I mean, there's a real cult of Fillion nowadays. People adore that man. Anytime he's at a convention, there's lines.
He's Canadian, too.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the voice of Green Lantern in the animated series, but you're not a comics fan, so...
No.
So there is a definitely cult of Fillion, and yeah, Scott, who was the actor that played the mayor?
Well, the mayor was Greg Hardy.
And what else has he been in?
Have you seen Brian De Palma's Body Double?
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm. So, Greg Henry was the... Craig Wasson's character had a friend who remember the friend who owned the house, and he wanted Craig Wasson to watch the house for him because he had a gig out of town for a few days, which of course sets the whole plot in motion with Craig Wasson witnessing the murder across the way.
Amazing. I'm a big fan of Body Double, actually.
Yes, that was the first time that I saw Greg Henry. Just a fat, and he's one of those guys, you know, you see him and you go, oh, yes, him. You know, he's the him guy.
He's been around
for so long. You know, I'm just scrolling through other credits of his, and he's got a million. But if I'm going back to the early days, I'm interested into what early stuff... you know, he was in an episode of Hardcastle.
Oh, that's notable.
He had an uncredited part in...
No spoilers for our Hardcastle and McCormick podcast coming up.
I knew it. Oh, of course. And this ties into... Here's your connective tissue right here. I knew it. He was in a different Jeff Lieberman film, Just Before Dawn.
Ah, amazing. Because there we go. I was looking for the segue. How we can go from Slither to Squirm. And you found it. Because this... Scott, this is why we had you back, my friend.
I knew I was fit for something.
It was a violent summer storm. Millions of volts slashed the earth.
That was the worst storm we've had since I was knee-high to a duck.
Folks talked about it and started getting things back to normal when Mick hit town for his vacation.
Well, it's straight ahead about 5 miles.
But things weren't normal. There were changes.
Mother bit me.
I never saw him bite like that.
Strange, frightful changes. That night, it all started.
Stop doing that.
I'm not doing anything.
This was the night of the crawling terror. American International presents Squirm.
Because yes, this is Squirm. This is so we are now shifting gears. We're moving away from Slither and then we're going to Squirm. Now, as I sort of joke when we were sort of, you know, going back and forth by email as to what we should talk about, I said Slither and Squirm kind of sounds like a really bad 90s grunge song, you know? Like something like Bush would put out or something, you know?
Be Bush or not 3 Days Grace, Three Doors Down, or someone of their ilk for sure. Who was the one? Who are the ones who sang is it Undone? I am the one who's going. Never mind.
I was going to say we're going to see this band on the Sunset Strip, Slither and Squirm.
Well, we're talking about songs. I mean, my brain was flashing back to like I'm Mother Earth or something. You know,
Rat. It's a Rat album. Or Dawkins.
You say 80s hair band. I say 90s grunge. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. You know,
the
whatever.
The only thing that's different is the hair.
Exactly. So yes, Jeff Lieberman, who directed Just Before Dawn, which was incredible. He also directed Blue Sunshine. Brilliant film.
Have you also seen the last feature that he directed, Satan's Little Helper?
That one I have not, no.
I'm not sure if it's still on Netflix or not, but if you get a chance, check it out. It's just as quirky and interesting as any of his other films.
Mm-hmm. And Lieberman is sort of quirky and interesting. I actually had I met him, and it was a very surprise meeting. I'll get into that a bit later on when we get to a particular scene, because he told me a story that was quite unbelievable. But, he made this one for $470,000.
Unbelievable.
Which, I mean, it was the 70s, so the dollar stretched a little further, but man, oh man. I mean, this, you know, it's funny because Chris had not seen Squirm before. And okay. I kept wanting to get him to, you know, I wanted us to do a Squirm podcast. And I just didn't sell it enough to Chris that when we were discussing our discussion with you, Chris is like, man, you just undersold me on that movie. That thing is joyous.
Yeah.
It's joyous.
I rewatched it. I rewatched it for the first time in quite some time, Friday night, and he's an amazing director. Everything's a little off kilter. Everything's
Indeed.
A little just left of center. And as with many 70s films, not all, but many, he's a very deliberate director. You know, the worms really don't start to hit the fan until almost halfway in the movie,
mm-hmm.
but there's enough interesting characters going on to get you to that point.
But, Scott, yes, I mean, the worms didn't make an appearance until later on in the film, but when they brought the worms, they brought the worms.
Hey, there's a few, and well, there's several scenes that are actually breathtaking, I think. From the worm, technically the worm point of view, there's like these casket hitting waves of worms. Oh. How they did it, what it actually is, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it completely sells what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. There are scenes where it looks like you have hundreds of thousands of worms just slithering and sliming their way around. What I read is that the production basically wiped out New England's entire supply of fishing worms because the filmmakers would order 250,000 worms at a time and just go through them for a scene and order another 250,000. I mean, there was just, it's a cornucopia, not a cornucopia, it's a bounty of worms. It's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
And again, you know, and that's been, God bless, you know, the 70s, 80s, and, you know, before CGI came in and ruined it, could you imagine how it would look now with the CGI worms waving around the screen? It would just look awful.
Well, there's our connective tissue with Kingdom of the Spiders. We have mass killings of insects slash worms. for art.
I have no doubt that, what did we lose? We lost quite a few, 5,000 spiders in Kingdom of the Spiders, half of which I'm sure no longer, are around or with us, and I'm sure literally hundreds and thousands of screaming worms are, sadly, no longer with us.
And they do scream too. We just don't have the auditory equipment to record it. Well, but I'm sure their screams are.
Can you emulate one of those screams, Chris?
No.
But what's great about this film? I mean, first of all, it is a animal attack film, and I love those films. You love those films. Chris loves those films. And all animals attack movies have some really just hastily, you know, explained and sort of, you know, just push aside to get the plot rolling, Deus Ex Machina for why the animals are doing what they're doing. And in this movie, it's right there in the opening credits. Fly Creek, electrical storm created a bizarre freak of nature. Boom. That's it.
You know what? And that's, damn it, that's the way every exploitation movie should be. I want to get to the good stuff. Just tell me what it's about. You know, give me a Star Wars scroll at the beginning. Give me all your exposition up front, and then let's get on with it.
I could have sworn I was watching Gone with the Wind with those accents.
Well, that.
Okay. You want? Okay. All right. Let's get this going then.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yep.
Okay. The girl who plays Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, Patricia. Let me look up her name here. Patricia Piercy. And the note that I wrote on Patricia Piercy. Let's see. A weird performance. Sounds like she keeps a flask of NyQuil in her back pocket. And I'm not saying she's a bad actress because she's good in some scenes, and then she goes off on these Nicolas Cage tangents of wide-eyed frenzy on her face that really has nothing to do with what's actually happening in the film. I couldn't take my eyes off her. I was like, I don't know what she's selling, but I'm buying.
And what about her mother with that exaggerated southern accent? It's so dark up there, you know, or something. What I read, I mean, this is IMDb, you know, their trivia, is that the actress who played the mother, her name is Jean Sullivan, because she was actually doing an homage to Tennessee Williams.
Oh, God bless her, because, yeah, when that thing starts off and she leans out the window and, Roger, would you like to come in for something to drink?
Yeah.
You
know, which one of y'all is going to be making dinner?
Oh, Lord, there's something evil around here. I don't know. And let's not forget our hero, Mick, who I will always, from when I saw the film and henceforth, refer to him as Egg Cream Boy.
Egg Cream Boy. Egg Cream Boy, and who Roger says later on in the film, you're going to be the worm face.
Yeah. Oh, what about, I mean, you know, when we talked about tourist trap, we were talking about how in the South, you know, they always put the stress on the first syllables. So instead of saying, like, police, they'll say police, or coyote is coyote, and here's like, New York. This is how they do it in New York. City boy. You know? In a lot of these films, you have the urban-rural divide, but in this one, it's absolutely ridiculous.
It's a chasm at this point, yeah.
Well, it's very much the South, you know, never fell, and here comes City Boy with his... It's right out of a catalog where he's got the fishing rod and the racket and the suitcase.
Yeah.
And he's bumbling and bumbling off the bus.
Oh, that was a great scene where his rod is in the face of his fellow passengers. He's struggling to get all his gear to the back. It was just fantastic.
Honestly, he was carrying enough equipment as if he was going to be like a sports and rec coordinator, or summer camp, or something. You know, as opposed to meeting his girlfriend or finding antiques or whatever the heck he was doing.
Yeah, he's taking a bus from New York to Georgia. Like Jesus, man, get on a plane.
I'm sure it's a bit of a trek. I've never been in Georgia. I have done. The wife and I did some southern traveling last summer, and I don't want to offend anyone, but it's a fairly accurate movie, even 40 years out. Just in terms of it really gets that small southern lifestyle to a T. You know, it's a great setup for the movie in that it's very simple. You know, he's on the bus. He gets off the bus. He meets up with Jerry, picks him up.
Don't forget, he falls into like some sort of bog or something before he
does. And she's, I don't know how she knew exactly where he would be coming through the forest.
Exactly.
Because
she's right there.
Waiting for him in the bog in case he, I don't know, fell in the quicksand or something.
We never do find out how they met. Maybe that's, you know, if anyone does a reboot.
Well, it's bizarre because she says, well, her mom says something like, well, what does he do? Well, he collects antiques. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not seeing her. I can't really see her, you know, flying into Sotheby's. Something like that. Oh, yeah, I met him at auction. No, I probably not.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole thing. He's there to, on one hand, woo Jerry, on the other hand, to go antiquing. I mean, what sort of treasures is he going to find in, like, Fly Creek, buttfuck, God knows where? You know what I mean? Like, it's just absolutely.
He's going to find in Fly Creek, you know, some old tires. I don't know what you're going to find in Fly Creek.
Robert E. Lee's belt buckle.
There you go. Other than skeletons buried in the mud.
Indeed.
And deep-sea diving helmets from the
20s. Yes. Another bar we'd love to frequent.
Exactly. Any bar where a bartender just kind of, you know, goes below and comes up wearing this bizarre, rusted, deep-sea diving helmet from, like, circa...
I think the drink was a Blue Lagoon.
I would definitely... I think the bars was Quigley's, because named after the proprietor. Mr. Quigley, who was also Mr. Sprinkles in Mrs. Doubtfire.
Ah. Whoa.
And I was watching and I'm like, who the hell is that? He looks so familiar. And the first one that popped in my head was he was the old morning kids show host on Mrs. Doubtfire that Robin Williams ended up replacing, but they made him the mailman.
Interesting. I've never seen Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I know. Many people have. I know. The drive-by fruiting. That's all I know. But anyway, that famous line. But anyway, getting back...
Well, it's no Some Like It Hot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're going to bring it. We're going to talk about those drag movies. Or, okay.
Well, that I've seen. I mean,
I have some great Priscilla Queen of the Desert stories, so let's go.
It all comes back to Slither in the end, right? With your, you know, with your karaoke bar.
Absolutely.
So yes. I mean, I call him. I gotta bring this back on track, guys. I'm sorry. But I call him Egg Cream Boy because you know when he walked into that what is it like?
So diner. Yeah.
Yeah, and he ordered his egg cream. Up to that point, I didn't even know what an egg cream was. And here is this.
Neither did I. I thought it was like someone puts like a fried egg floating on a malt or something. That's what I thought an egg cream was.
But the filmmakers were good enough to tell us what it was. Because when City Boy orders his egg cream, and they, what's an egg cream? And he said, well, it's just chocolate with a bit of water and some seltzer to give it some head. There you go. There's your egg cream.
Hey, you got a recipe right there.
Yeah, beautiful. Forget about the worms and the exploitation. You got a recipe for a tasty drink.
Absolutely. But, you know, and here's another thing I think that Squirm has in common with Slither, is a very, they're completely different, but a very likable lead actor, mm-hmm. you know? I think I had seen Don Scardino,
yep.
Plays, I had seen him first before I saw Squirm. I'd seen him in a movie he had made after Squirm. He knows You're Alone. So that was from 1981.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a slasher movie where a guy is targeting women who are about to get married. And he kills them before his wedding because he was jilted at the altar by his wife. And it was Tom Hanks' film debut.
I wrote about that. I did a list of, like, you know, 12 A-list actors who starred in horror, and I actually just watched a Tom Hanks scene. That's why it sounded familiar to me. But no, I hadn't seen the film.
So anyway, Don Scardino plays the lead in it, Marvin, who he works in a morgue. But right from the time I saw him, he's just very likable.
Mm-hmm.
And in that movie, and as well as this one, you like Mick right from the start. You're rooting for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's probably the most pleasant, ginger on screen since Ralph the Mouth.
Interesting fact about that film is that Tom Hanks was meant to be killed off. He was just there for one scene to deliver some exposition. He was meant to be killed off, but because he was just so gosh darn likable, the producers actually decided not to kill his character off.
You can't kill off Tom Hanks.
Well, they did in Philadelphia.
Oh.
Well, they did, and Saving Private Ryan. Actually, there might be a few movies.
No Charlie Sheen jokes.
Too soon, but Chris. Yeah. Too soon.
No. But Hanks is, and again, you know, the likability factor with Scardino, for me, is off the scales. He's just, mm-hmm. he's so cheerful, and he really does, for me, he really pulls me through those slower parts of the first half of the mm-hmm. work.
And also, when I met Lieberman, and he mentioned that that Scardino has become a very successful producer in Hollywood. I don't know offhand what films he's produced, but you know he's actually really made something of himself. And I'm like, that guy, Egg Cream Boy, give me a break. That's what I said.
Egg Cream Worm Face Boy did a lot of TV directing,
mm-hmm.
and he actually made his feature film directing debut not more than 2 years ago when he directed the incredible Burt Wonderstone.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Okay, film. Not the greatest, but mildly entertaining.
Not bad, but you know, he's if the direction is fine, he's certainly no Dennis Dugan.
For sure. Yep. Another thing I find very interesting about Mick, besides his proclivity for egg creams, is the fact that he for a large part of the film, he reminds me of Hamlet, just walking around carrying a human skull.
It's such an oddly paced film. If you were to say to someone that's never seen a horror movie, watch this, and about 15 minutes in, they were going, "What is this thing?" They would have no idea. It's absolutely this bizarre, for the first half, it's this bizarre southern drama.
Mm-hmm. No,
you know, this mm-hmm. like really warped Gone with the Wind, the fish out of water. It's like it's one of those films where you just say to someone, just watch it.
You gotta love the instant dislike that the sheriff took to the city boy. Like, it was
my God.
That where did that enemy come from? I have no idea, but it was huge, you know.
he really hates Mick. He I'm assuming his great grandpappy was killed in the Civil War.
Indeed, yeah.
But looks like a cross between Jerry Reed and Conway Twitty.
Indeed, yeah.
Interesting fact: I went to Conway Twitty's house.
No, come on.
Yeah,
in Twitty City.
Twitty City. It's outside of Nashville.
I haven't been to Twitty City. I have been to Memphis, but I haven't been to Twitty City.
Was it Twitty City or was it Shitty City?
It was a little combination of both.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, he just hates him. I mean, when he's eating the spaghetti and he goes, "This place would take me 10 or 15 minutes to eat," and that's a good head start, City Boy.
Okay, I got a question. Where in Fly Creek do they have an Italian restaurant? Sly Creek is not the most cosmopolitan town in the world.
Is Spaghetti the most cosmopolitan town in the
Oh, no, but this place looked pretty authentic. They had a picture of the Leaning Tower of Pisa on the wall.
I guarantee it exists. There's a little burg in Alberta here called Longview that has 300 people, and they have an Italian restaurant.
Well, we can't talk about Squirm without talking about Roger. And again, this comes from IMDb, so sometimes the facts are a little suspect. But what they say, what they wrote in the trivia section is that Sylvester Stallone, Sly himself, aggressively pursued the role of Roger. And not only that, but Kim Basinger auditioned for Jerry.
No.
Well, that would have been a different movie.
Indeed. And I mean, of course, Roger is, your typical slow-witted, dim-witted sort of...
Yeah, exploitation stereotype. But, mm-hmm. Okay, when did Rocky come out? 76.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This thing came out in 76, so this was... He was just looking for anything?
But this would have been Lenz before 76.
Okay, so he was just a struggling guy living in his car, whatever he was doing when he was penning Rocky.
We know the story of Rocky.
Okay.
He also made a porn, so hey, what's going on?
Well, he was in Rhinestone, so we know he has an affinity for the Deep South.
Oh, there's not enough time. He's made a lot of great movies, but oh my God, he's made some duds. But you know what's interesting about Roger is, I think, other than Tunt Spardino, this guy, Ari Dow, it's probably the best performance in the movie, and he never made another movie again.
You know, that's interesting, because the raw charisma of Roger is incredible. He is good. Yeah. And what I find amazing about Roger is that he goes from being, your typical sort of dim-witted country bumpkin to, I think he's one of the first major victims of the worms in an incredible scene.
Incredible.
Yes, with the makeup work of Rick Baker.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, both. Rick Baker, man. Have you seen The Incredible Melting Man?
Have I seen Incredible Melting Man? That sits proudly on the shelf.
Who am I talking to? Another fantastic one with amazing effects work by an embryonic Rick Baker.
Yes. Here's another interesting, I think, correlation between this and Slither, mm-hmm. is you have your alien situation in Slither along with the sort of antagonist of Grant, and then in Squirm you have the worms, obviously, but really Roger turns out to be just as much of a threat mm-hmm. as the worms.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, after he became what you would assume would just be worm food. No, I mean, he survives and he becomes a cross between the Incredible Hulk and Jason Voorhees. I mean, the guy is unstoppable and he's got superhuman strength.
I would have thought that if all those worms burrowed into your face like that it may have slowed you down a little, but I guess, a little bit of Bactine or some iodine and, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, as you said, it's not enough that we have a billion worms. And this is not hyperbole. I mean, it looks like a billion worms, but then we got Roger, the unstoppable Roger. It just becomes B-movie, exploitation, whatever you want to call it, Nirvana. Because when everything starts to come together, the worms, Roger just... unstoppable, he wants Jerry,
Jerry, and the not-so-jolly Roger has this amazing battle with Mick in the woods.
It's glorious.
It's one of my... So, when the tree falls on the house...
Does anybody hear?
Does anybody hear, A? And B, the tree falls on the house, and there's a big hole in the front of the house, and Mick decides he's going to go look for a piece of plywood.
And don't you need any help? No, I can handle it myself.
I can handle it myself. And you literally see him walking through the woods with this huge piece of plywood.
Well, in all fairness, who's going to help him? Not the sheriff. He gave him 15 minutes to get out of town, right?
Could we look for it? Maybe there's some wood around here. Maybe we could do... No, I'm going to go out. I'll go to the next Home Depot and get some plywood. And I'm going to walk down.
Well...
And then, before Mick gets back to the house and it gets dark, the mom says, I've opened the back door to get a breeze going.
And they had her best Tennessee Williams.
You know what? The 20-foot by 20-foot hole in your front
never thought of that.
Oh my god. And then, you know, we can't forget Sister Alma, who I will say, not a looker.
Oh, she's a personality. Personality first gal. Just, again, you know, God bless the 70s, because he was obviously casting for, he just wanted to pick someone, okay, you're a sister. It's not, find me some 18-year-old stripper to play the sister. And he actually probably had girls come in and audition for the sister. He liked her reading. And then he put her up on screen and probably went, okay. All right, well, I've hired her, so let's carry on.
And she falls into that tickle trunk after she gets high. It's a great scene after she does her pedicure.
But, I mean, that scene when she opens up the door and all those worms come out. I mean, holy shit, man. Just it's like a dump truck just pulled up.
That's weird that you mentioned that, because the showerhead worms got to me.
The showerhead worms. I love the showerhead worms. I like how when you turn, it's like a Play-Doh machine. When you turn the on, they come out. When you turn it off, they go back up.
Yeah.
I mean, we got to talk about Willie. Willie, who plays Roger's father.
Barney, old bastard. gives Roger the old tongue lashing. Gives him the old lecture, the old worm lecture.
Yep.
And responsibility, and told you, now you don't give out my damn truck. Oh, I love Willie.
When I met Jeff Lieberman, and it was interesting, because I was at a comic convention, which it was the Niagara Comic Con about maybe 5 years ago, and they had a few horror guests there, but Jeff Lieberman was on advertised to be there, and I'm walking up and down the aisles, and this was not where all the guests kind of are, like the celebrity guests, just a little table, and I see a poster for Squirm, and I'm like, holy shit, you're Jeff Lieberman, director of Squirm, Blue Sunshine, Just Before Dawn. He's like, yeah. And we just chatted for about 45 minutes, and he told me some amazing stories. At the time, I didn't have a podcast, so I wasn't recording it. I wish I had one, because some of the stories were incredible. But one of the stories he did tell me, and it's about the actor Carl Degenhardt, who played Willie. He said that Carl Degenhardt was a mean old drunk.
His only screen role, I'm taking it?
Well, we'll have to ask Scott. Was it his only screen role?
I don't know. I don't know if that was his only role or not. You carry on with the story, and I'll look him up.
Yeah, he was basically a local, and he was just a mean old drunk, and for his big scene where, you know, they open up his shirt and he's just got his chest cavity filled with worms, as you probably know, they buried him standing up, so it was just his head peeking above ground, and they had some sort of prosthetic body with the worms, and that scene required multiple takes and a few hours of shooting. So you have this mean drunk Degenhardt buried up to his neck in the ground. So he said basically they were paying Degenhardt, this is Lieberman's words, in Jack Daniels. So as long as he had a bottle of JD in his hand when they weren't rolling film, he was happy, and he went through about four or five bottles throughout the filming of that one particular scene.
I accept that currency as well.
I wouldn't go for Jack, but any other kind of alcohol, probably you could bury me up to my neck too and do what you like. Worm was, in fact, his only film. So there's a few here that the only two, I think, who did any acting outside of this movie was Scardino and, God bless her, Jerry, Patricia Piercy.
Well, she's kind of a winsome ginger.
You know what? Like I said, she's like a Jessica Chastain, but the rubber band snapped, and he just started rolling.
Mm-hmm. Now,
you know, like Jessica Chastain mixed in with Nicolas Cage. but she's, you know, and you have to say this for her, and, you know, small things count, but you can't take your eyes off her. She is attractive, and it's at the very least a very interesting performance.
Mm-hmm. And she does provide us with the requisite nipple for an exploitation film, too.
Well, yeah, of course.
When we were talking about Kingdom of the Spiders and also Devil's Reign, Scott, and you're saying that 70s movies, and I agree with you 100%, are largely downers, right? Well, this one was not so much of a downer. There was a slightly happy-ish ending. I mean, yes, most of the town did become worm food, but our hero and heroine do survive. I mean, they find themselves up in that...
And the sister, Alma, survives as well.
Mm-hmm. But this is the thing. You have to now educate me just a wee bit, Scott, because, you know, they escape the house. I mean, the house is just riddled with
billions of worms, and they find themselves up in a treetop, and they fall asleep, and they spend the night, and they wake up, and there's a hiker worker down below, and he says, power's back on. He didn't say the worms are gone. He just said, power's back on. All is good. Weird thing. Nobody's around. Now, let me ask you, how in God's name was this hiker worker able to do his work with all those worms around?
And if you were really paying attention, earlier in the movie, that's not where the lines went down. So the lines went down in a neighboring town, and that's where they were repaired. And this guy, being the great, you know, city worker, that
civil servant, yep,
county worker,
yep,
was coming around to let everyone know in trees, you know, that the power was back up. He was just doing his, you know, his civic duty. But the power went down in a different town in the same county. And then he was just coming by and knowing all the tree dwellers that the power was back up. You know, it's one of those creature features that, because worms are generally so, as disgusting as they are, I find, so harmless, you've got to bring the worms. You've got to bring the worms, and it's the only way something like this is going to work. Like your beetles, your spiders, etc. You have to go in mass quantities, like Costco size. Worm buckets. And they bring it, and that's why it works, is because you're, like you said, you're overwhelmed with the worms, and there's that fantastic scene in the living room when the worms take over the house, and Roger falls over the banister into the sea, literally a sea of worms, and it's filmed so eerily and beautifully that you actually, I don't know how it's done, I don't know if you asked him how that was done, but it literally looks like a sea of worms that Roger is sucking into. It's incredible.
Yeah, and also when the worms were all over the mother, that was an incredible scene as well.
Yeah, and again, I say to people who don't have the patience for the older movies, you know, just stick around, because it gets messy, and there is a payoff, and you have to, and seeing, you know, Lieberman's other movies, It's very deliberate. He knows what he's doing. He paces it like that for a reason, so that when you do find, I think if you had, you know, worm attacks in the first 5 minutes and then every 10 minutes, like you're supposed to pace out stupidly a horror movie, when you get to those scenes like the quicksand, as you said, or the sea of worms, it wouldn't have that impact at all, I don't think.
Because, yes, I mean, you're right. I mean, just wait a bit, and when they decide to bring it, they're going to bring it. And, man, when they bring it, it's just a thing of beauty. And this film is a thing of beauty. I can't recommend it more high. I mean, it's one of my faves. I adore it.
It is great, and it still plays. I don't know what the box office was on it, what it was like back when it came out in 76, but, man, you know, so, as in every decade, so many films fall by the wayside, but it's a really unique, even for a creature feature, it's a really unique take on it. It's your first half is, you know, like we said, you know, Gone with the Wind meets, you know, the Hardy Boys, where they're trying to solve the mystery of Mr. Beerbeef's disappearance, and then they drop this, you know, sea change of worms on you, with people getting picked to the bones. It's absolutely bizarre, and it's absolutely delightful.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Chris, any final words on Squirm?
No, I'm just about to run up a tab at Quigley's and Henenlotter's.
Oh, you know it. And I want. They should make those deep-sea diving helmets. They should make those the drinking vessels for the Blue Lagoon.
Well, what I might do is I might try an egg cream for the very first time. That's how I might spend my afternoon. Well, Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you as always. And anytime you want to come back on the podcast, you're always welcome, my friend.
Guys, it's always a pleasure. I love chatting with you guys. Anytime you guys invite me, I am there no matter what the film is, whether it's as good as Squirm or as good as Slither. I'm always there. Always. Great time.
And yet again, if our listeners want to read some of your excellent writing, they can go to?
They can go to dailydead.com. My column is called Driving Dust Offs, where every week I have love letters to films just like Squirm, from the driving era of 55 for Deadly Magazine, and if you head over to Twitter and look for the gorgeous naked Burt Reynolds Abby at Phantasm 2, that is me, and let's chat.
Awesome.
Excellent. Well, Scott, yet again, been a pleasure, and have a wonderful afternoon.